Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hannah, my love, why is your cheek so pale? How chance the roses there do fade so fast?
Belike for want of rain, which I could well beteem them from the tempest of mine eyes.
Ay me, for aught that I could ever read, could ever hear by tale or history, the course of true love never did run smooth.
Hello and welcome to The Play's the Thing, your podcast for all things Shakespeare. You have joined us for Act One of A Midsummer Night's Dream. You just heard a little bit of Act One. That was Lysander and Hermia. The course of true love never did run smooth, and we will find that out as we go through this play. I am joined by not one guest, not two guests, but three guests. I'm going to start with Heidi White, because Heidi and I are on another podcast together, Close Reads, but Heidi has been a little bit of a stranger to this show, Heidi. That's purple. I think it's because, would you say purple?
I said it's hurtful. My feelings hurt.
Your feelings are hurt?
Yeah.
I think it's because you're in such high demand, we can't afford you anymore. I think that's what's going on.
People are getting paid for this?
Moving on.
This is news to me.
Let me tell you a little bit about Heidi. Heidi is a teacher, editor, podcaster, and author. She teaches humanities at St. Hild School in Colorado Springs, is a regular contributor to our sister podcast, Close Reads, and is the author of the forthcoming book, The Divided Soul, Reuniting Duty and Desire in Literature and Life. Heidi, welcome back to A Midsummer Night's Dream. I know this is one of your favorites.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
My pleasure. Our other two guests are Emily and Ian Andrews. Emily is Associate Director for Center for Lit and a candidate for the MA in Humanities at Faulkner University. She lives and works in Spokane, Washington, where she reads, writes, podcasts, and reads. Emily, welcome back.
Thank you.
We had you and Ian on for Two Gentlemen of Verona, and it went so well that I insisted on bringing you back again.
That was so much fun.
You guys both, yeah. And you both were like, ooh, can we do Midsummer Night's Dream?
We are,
and here we
delighted
are
to be here. And with Heidi, who I haven't seen in
That's
such a
right.
long time.
I know. This is like a reunion.
Let me tell you about Ian. He's Associate Director for Center for Lit and host of Bibliophiles, a podcast for lit lovers. When he's not working, he spends time pursuing his MA in Biblical and Theological Studies at Knox Theological Seminary, and indulging an abiding passion for film and television. Ian, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here too. I'm going to start with a popularity question. Several years ago, Britons were polled about what plays they knew from Shakespeare's canon, what plays they had either seen or read. Okay?
Either.
Seen or okay. read. That's right. Those were the, there's the, I think the only two criteria, and they ranked all 37 plays from most to least popular. Does anyone, I would like for all three of you in the order in which you were introduced to tell me what place you think A Midsummer Night's Dream is in the 37 rankings.
What a tricky question.
Oh, third. It's a tricky question.
I think it's third.
You think it's third. Heidi thinks it's third. Emily?
I was going to say third, but I can't know, so I'll say second.
Okay. Okay.
I'm going to go lower. Great. I'm going to say fifth.
Okay. Third, second, and fifth. The answer is third.
Nice.
The answer is third.
Can I make a guess on what comes first? Romeo and
please
Juliet?
Please do.
Romeo and Juliet and Macbeth.
You're exactly. How did you know that?
I just guessed. That just seems like the right ranking to me. This is why I'm in such high demand and why I get paid so much.
Totally. Totally. You are like a ranking expert.
I wonder if we could get all of the top 10 if we thought about it.
Okay, let's try it. I think this is fun. So Romeo and Juliet, number one, Macbeth, number two, Midsummer Night's Dream, number three. What is number four?
Much Ado About Nothing.
I was going to, yeah.
It is not Much Ado About Nothing.
Is it
Hamlet?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's Hamlet.
It's got to be Hamlet.
It's Hamlet. Fifth?
I'm going to go with Much Ado.
Still not Much Ado.
It's still not.
Lear?
That's so surprising. Yeah, maybe Lear.
Not Lear. This is a tough one.
Merchant of Venice.
Merchant of Venice. Well done. Well
good,
done.
Good one. Good job, Ian.
Then one more before we get to Much Ado About I saved you guys there. I saved you.
Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
That's. I would have guessed that it's not Julius Caesar.
12th Night.
12th? How did you know that, Emily? I would have never guessed 12th Night. It's 12th Night.
Honestly,
then just Much Ado About Nothing.
So is and that then, seven?
That is seven.
Three left in the top 10. It's not three Anthony more. Cleopatra.
Nope.
That's way lower.
I think King Lear is probably in the top 10. Maybe number 10.
So. It's not. It's not.
How on earth?
Okay.
Othello?
Okay.
Othello is ninth.
Okay.
Mm. Okay. Is it a history play? Or it got to be Julius Caesar?
It's not Henry V?
No.
How?
No. Or it's a comedy.
It's a comedy.
Comedy.
As You Like It?
This is a surprising comedy. Are we surprised right now? The Tempest.
The Tempest is number 10.
Okay.
So we're missing number 8.
You're missing number 8.
What on earth?
A comedy.
A comedy or a romance?
Well, that's a fun question.
What's the difference?
Exactly.
What's the difference? It's definitely a romance and it's definitely
a
comedy.
Tale?
No.
Taming of the Shrew.
Taming of the Shrew.
I'm so surprised that it's Taming.
Aren't you so surprised?
But I guess right now it is kind of a cultural moment for Shrew. I've seen it done a couple of times in a very subversive kind of way.
No kidding.
So this
it's on the comeback.
That was so fun.
Okay,
that was fun.
Now here's my follow-up question to that. Why is Midsummer Night's Dream the third most popular Shakespeare play? I would love to hear your best explanation about why Midsummer is so popular.
I think one of the reasons is probably because it has such, it has very memorable lines, like the course of true love never did run smooth. Yep. Love is blind. Love is right. It has a lot of, and it's very characteristic of Shakespearean comedy. It has pretty much every classic element of Shakespearean comedy in there. And so it seems kind of like the classic, if you're going to put on a high school or college production, go with Midsummer. And it's just a really great play. It's his first great comedy. And the characters are really fun. And it actually has some pretty profound contemplations that shine through the lighthearted plot. I think that's, it's just kind of all around delightful. What do you guys think?
Well, it's also his first play to include the supernatural. And I think that the fairy element captures the imagination. And it's like this glorious combination of classical fairyhood, but also English countryside that I think sticks in the popular imagination.
Yeah, my answer is a lot simpler than Emily's, but to the same point, Puck. Puck is why this play is popular. I mean, has to be on the top three or four most iconic characters in all of Shakespeare's corpus.
I'm expecting the two of you to be very agreeable on this podcast because, well, to each other, because you are married to one another. The course of your true love has run smooth.
Almost like you've never hung out with us.
I was just going to say, Heidi, have you been on a podcast with these?
All right, so we've got a real marriage. This is exciting.
I don't know. You've been married and you still think we're going to be agreeable in the air, huh?
I can't wait.
I have another theory to add to the stew. I think my first vote would be this is the high school performance, mm-hmm. right?
Hmm.
Like,
what do you mean?
Because I think there's a few different reasons why this is. I think if you just polled public high school performances, what is your most performed Shakespeare play? It would not be Romeo and Juliet. It would not be Macbeth. It would be Midsummer Night's Dream. And I think there's a few reasons why. There's no violence, relatively no violence. You don't have to have two great actors to play Romeo and Juliet, or even one really great actor to play Macbeth and another really great actor to play Lady Macbeth. You can have a bunch of actors that are just kind of getting their feet underneath them, and you can sprinkle them throughout the play, because who's the lead in A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Yeah.
Puck is maybe the most popular character, but is he the lead? He doesn't have enough stage time to really be the lead.
Yeah. Right. That's true.
That's interesting.
Yeah, when we have two sets of lovers, to your point.
We have two sets of lovers,
interchangeable,
right.
Which is also totally. Part
so you
of
could
the
say
whole
there aren't any necessary starring roles, or they're all starring roles.
Right. Well, everybody gets a part.
Everybody gets a part.
Which is kind of representative of like the public education like approach to excellence.
Yeah, fair enough.
Hello? I did say that.
Good job. You did. You really just went for it.
There's a lot of other like memorable characters, Bottom, Oberon, the fairy. Okay, but I haven't even really said what my other theories. My other theory is this. Think about who actually chooses the plays that get performed in high schools or in theaters. Like, who's the person that makes that decision? It's the director. A director will say, hey, I want to do Death of a Salesman this year, or I want to do, you know, Goodnight Mother, or whatever the play is. And I think that this play, more than any other play of Shakespeare's, is the director's play. And what I mean by that is the play begs for elaborate staging, for creative blocking, for really fun and fanciful costuming. As a matter of fact, there's a really good free YouTube complete production that I was watching last night. It's got to be one of the most elaborate productions that I've ever seen on a stage. Mm-hmm. It starts, just to give you a little hint, it starts with this big kind of bell-shaped sheet that is hanging from the rafters down toward the stage and up into the... So imagine just a big kind of cupped sheet, and growing into this cupped sheet, just think about the expense for a second as I'm describing this, is a multi-brambled trunked tree that's growing up into this sheet. And the first thing that we see, and I don't really know what it meant right now, is a guy step out from the side stage with a, a chainsaw. And he cuts the brambles of the tree, and this kind of belled ballooned sheet kind of lifts up to the ceiling, and then later lowers, and there are characters within it. And we've only gotten to like the first 30 seconds of the play. Like, I don't think that any like words have actually been exchanged yet. So that's why my contention is this play is directors love to show off in this play. I don't know what you would call it. It's a canvas. Mm. It's a canvas for the director's paint. So I think it gets chosen often enough. And I've said all that. because I need to tell you, this is not my favorite Shakespeare play. And I'm hoping that this podcast will turn it around. This has happened from time to time. I've shown up for the plays, the thing, kind of a little bit grumpy in my heart the play is not my favorite play. And then I get halfway in and I'm like, oh, when I talk about it with friends, I kind of fall in love with it a little bit. So,
well, all 37 of them can't be your favorite.
If they can't all be my favorite.
The whole thing.
They can't all be my favorite. And like, I need to say, I showed up with Sarah Jane Bentley and Brandon LeBlanc for Troilus and Cressida, ready to have my heart changed. And it definitely didn't. That play. Oh my gosh. That play, you guys, I love William Shakespeare.
You came out of that podcast shaken in your belief about Shakespeare's identity, though. So.
No. Well, no. That's not the one. It was the one afterwards. Sarah Jane and I did a kind of like, she mentions in Troilus and Cressida, I'm not sure that Shakespeare is the author of the plays. I was like, Sarah Jane, come on.
Yeah. What I would say to people who say that is, in this Christian home, we believe in William Shakespeare.
Thank you. Yeah.
As for me and my household.
I can do no other.
I shall
other.
Not recant.
That's me right. off to prison.
That's right.
The stake first. The stake.
Yeah, right, know, right, right,
Tim,
right.
Tim is being led over to the dark side these days.
I'm actually, oh, man. We should, brother. We should not have that discussion now. I will just say my faith has been shaken and I am not a like Shakespeare truther. I'm like, no, it's the glove maker from Stratford-upon-Avon. Yeah, it's that guy.
Okay. Really quick though. I know that you talked to James Shapiro, of which I will always be jealous. You have read his book, Contested Will, right?
No. And someone kind of called
Please
me out.
Do.
Yeah. They called me out and they were just like, dude, he's going to slap you down. So what I would really love to do is get Gwen, the author of this kind of like Shakespeare's not the author book, and James Shapiro in the same room at the same time and just like turn the mics on. But you know what? That might be beyond the capacity of even this noble Shakespeare podcast. Let me just set up act one of our play. It begins relatively simply, like many other Shakespeare plays. There is a couple that's in love that is being barred from their love by a father, a nobleman. So Aegeus arrives to this wedding with his daughter Hermia and her two suitors, Lysander, that's who Hermia wants to marry, and Demetrius, this is the man that her father wants her to marry. So Aegeus demands, Theseus, you've got to settle this for us, enforce Athenian law upon Hermia, execute her if she refuses to marry Demetrius. And so Theseus threatens Hermia. Either, listen, you get lifelong chastity or you get death if you continue to disobey your dad. And so Lysander and Hermia make plans. They're going to flee Athens and they reveal this plan to Helena, Hermia's best friend. Now, Helena is in love with Demetrius, right? Oh yeah, the plot thickens. And to win Demetrius' favor, Helena says, hey, I'm going to tell Demetrius the plan that Lysander and Hermia have. So, hey, she tells him they're going to elope. Lysander and Hermia are going to elope. And that's basically our setup. And then we cut to, somewhat randomly, six Athenian tradesmen who have decided to put on a play called Pyramus and Thisbe. They're putting it on for Theseus and Hippolyta's wedding. And these men are kind of choosing their parts. And then they agree they're going to meet a little bit later in the woods outside of Athens. So the majority of our play is going to happen in these woods outside of Athens. But the hook of the play happens within Athens, kind of in preparation for this wedding. That's where we are. Okay. Are you guys like thrown off by the complications of Act One? Are you like, no, this is easy to track. I got this.
Well, on the one hand, it's Shakespeare, so I get it. On the other hand, he's fond of drawing these caricatures. I mean, how many fathers are willing to just do away with their daughters if they don't marry the man they want them to? Like, that seems like he's rounding to the nearest wild there as a character. But it's part of the course.
Say that again. He's rounding to the nearest
to the nearest wild.
I've never heard that before. What is it?
It might be a family expression. It just means someone who is so intent upon their goal that they're willing to do literally anything, whether it actually furthers their goal or not.
I see.
It's a good idiom. That should sweep the nation.
It should spread. You know, this is a little bit of an aside, but I showed up to college with all kinds of idioms that I'd grown up around, and slowly over the course of my education found from fellow students that many of them were inherited from my Southern grandfather, who grew up in an era where segregation was still a thing. And so some of those idioms do not need to be carried forward.
Right. They had a meaning that you didn't know.
I was not aware of them.
Connected to. Okay. Wow.
That led to some funny and some unfortunate situations.
I'm going to put you on the spot, Ian, and you can gladly push this by. Do you remember any of those idioms that are like, I don't mean like the really like dangerous ones, but the ones that would be kind of obscure to us?
Well, the thing about my grandfather is he doesn't like to curse.
Okay.
But many of the idioms involved cursing.
Sure. So, Christian substitute kind of thing.
Yeah.
Dag nabbit.
I grew up with, he doesn't know crud from putty. The original idiom, of course, is not crud.
Yeah.
Right, you fill in the other word. And not putty, but shinola.
Oh.
So I got to college saying crud from putty, and someone looked at me and said, you mean from shinola?
Yeah.
But
that is so great.
The least offensive of all of them, I assure you.
I'm going to incorporate that into everyday use, crud from putty.
Yeah. You should not do that. That's not so. No.
You're a grown-up
human.
How about dumber than owl manure? That was the one.
Oh, that's a great one. I've never heard that one either.
I kind of like that one, actually.
We're far afield from Shakespeare here.
We are.
That's my bad.
I don't know. He made up a lot of words. So
that's true. He did.
The beginning of this play, we're not into the magic yet. No, but we get a complaint from Aegeus to Theseus, blaming Hermia's love for Lysander on bewitching. Mm-hmm. He says, this man hath bewitched the bosom of my child. What's the role that magic is going to play within this piece?
Emily, it was you who brought this up earlier. Do you have any first thoughts on this? The magic?
Sure. I think I have a hypothesis that it has something to do with it also being kind of pastoral, and that these people are being led out of the urban setting into the forest. And the magic of it is that everything is upside down and backwards and sideways in the forest due to this magic. And in Shakespeare, the supernatural realm is always, it's always where you go to get your ideas challenged and shaken up. And I think that's what's going to happen here. And it's very like, Paul is going to be quoted or misquoted several times here. And I think it has a lot to do with...
The Apostle Paul.
Right. Yes. I think it has a lot to do with the gospel idea of everything being turned upside down. The last becomes first. The weak becomes strong. That there's something in the magic realm where... your vision. It's a lens through which your vision is challenged. Mm.
I really like that. I think that's right, because what the very first scene that we have in this play, Act 1, Scene 1, begins with Theseus and Hippolyta. And Theseus has won Hippolyta, as he says, through violence, right? Mm. He says right away, I have won you as my bride. I think he says through harming her or something like that. And so this question of power is very relevant in the play and hierarchy. Where do people belong? Who gets to make choices for themselves and for others? And that speaks exactly to what you're saying, Emily, that magic becomes this disordering force or an ordering force, right? And that's the question, that's the complexity of the play, because we have a lot of disorder in Act 1, Scene 1, a lot of the strong imposing their will upon the weak. And it happens to be men imposing their will upon women. And so this is one of those plays that I think kind of begs for a feminist interpretation. And in modernity, this play is often interpreted in a very feminist kind of power struggle kind of way. I've seen multiple performances of this play when Hippolyta is in chains in Act One, Scene One, when she doesn't want to marry Theseus, she's being forced into it against her will. And it does beg for that, I think, but I think that the deeper and truer way of reading that is that it becomes a question of power and hierarchy. And what is the real world? Is it this, is it the urban world in which the strong is imposing upon the weaker? Or is it this magical fairy world when everything's kind of up for grabs and people have a lot more freedom? And yet do they really have more freedom there because they're being enchanted right and left? And isn't that power and strong exerting itself over the weak? And so there actually is a lot of complexity in the question of power and freedom within this play.
Absolutely.
In some ways, Act One is an over-organized society, or like a hyper-organized society in a way. And entering this kind of magical realm is, as Emily said, it's kind of an opportunity maybe for, you know, like a reordering, a flipping of this very kind of rigid, kind of ordered society. Heidi, I'm thinking about the last play I think that you were on with me was The Tempest. And The Tempest, almost all of The Tempest occurs in what you called a green world. Do you want to talk a little bit about, I mean, do you think that's what this different realm that we're going to enter in Act Two, is it a green world that we're going to be entering?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of Shakespeare's comedies have what scholars, commentators often call the green world, which is exactly what Emily said. I mean, she described it very well. This realm in which all bets are off, when you don't have civilization imposed upon the characters that enter into this green world. We see it in The Tempest. We see it a little bit in Merchant of Venice with Belmont, and definitely in Midsummer Night's Dream. This is probably the most obvious one, although it's also in As You Like It, right? The Forest of Arden. Mm-hmm. And it's a realm where the rules are suspended and a new societal order, a new social order, and a new psychological order comes through the suspension of the rules in the green world. And this is something Shakespeare really had to create in order to get rid of the rules, so to speak, and examine what it would be like, because he was a late medieval / Renaissance playwright. And so the world was a very orderly place. And so he didn't have kind of this freedom to create whatever he wanted. He had to create a space within his place, a fictional place where his characters could go and reorder their society and in a way that might potentially be more just. And in this particular play, the father figure is brutally unjust in Act One, Scene One. Both Theseus and Egeus are especially Egeus. And Theseus is a really complicated character. But with Egeus, we have like a father who's clearly irrational and yet backed up by the leader, right? And so they have to go somewhere else in order to find freedom and reordering. And some of the complexity of the play comes through, are they really free even in the green world, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This green world idea is so prominent in the last full-length play that we did, The Winter's Tale. So Emily Maeda and I just finished the Q&A session for The Winter's Tale. The first 2.5 acts occur in Sicilia, very ordered, very regimented, and once again, dominated by this, just a tyrant. And then we switch halfway through the play and 16 years later to Bohemia. And the first scene in Bohemia is in a way, a sort of reckoning of what the worst fears of Sicilia are about Bohemia. We start with a pickpocket in Bohemia. He's stealing from people, right? And it's just kind of like, I think Shakespeare is having a little fun there. Like, this is exactly what Sicilia says that Bohemia is like. It's just like, it's nothing but chaos and licentiousness and immorality. And then the next scene is just a huge party. And it's so much fun. And there's dancing and there's singing and there's so much freedom there. And that begins to unwind the terrible damage that's done in the first two and a half, three acts of The Winter's Tale. So I'm curious what kind of strategy Shakespeare is going to employ using his magic in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Is it going to be like the Tempest magic? Is it going to be like the magic of Bohemia in The Winter's Tale? That's kind of one of the questions that I have going forward. Love is all over this play. Emily was asking whether or not we were talking about, like, is the third play or our third most popular play a comedy or a romance? This play seems to me like a little bit more romance than comedy, but it's really funny also. I want to talk about the vision of love in this play, and I want to hear from Helena. So I'm going to play a little bit of audio. The thing that I want everyone to listen to in the middle of this monologue from Helena is two lines. Love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind, and therefore is winged Cupid painted blind. Let's listen to Helena from Act One of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
How happy some or other some can be. Through Athens I am thought as fair as she. But what of that? Demetrius thinks not so. He will not know what all but he do know. And as he errs, doting on Hermia's eyes, so I, admiring of his qualities. Things base and vile, holding no quantity, love can transpose to form and dignity. Love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind. And therefore is winged Cupid painted blind. As waggish boys in game themselves forswear, so the boy Love is perjured everywhere. For ere Demetrius looked on Hermia's eyne, he hailed down oaths that he was only mine. And when this hail some heat from Hermia felt, so he dissolved, and showers of oaths did melt. I will go tell him of fair Hermia's flight. Then to the wood will he tomorrow night pursue her. And for this intelligence, if I have thanks, it is a dear expense. But herein mean I to enrich my pain, to have his sight thither and back again.
That was Helena saying, love looks not with the eyes, but with the mind, and therefore is winged Cupid painted blind. How is Helena's vision of love? Is it set in contrast with what we've seen of love in the first part of this play, Ian? Do you see a distinction being drawn by our playwright?
This is a confusing monologue for me. Oh, yeah. I don't know that I have a great answer to that. I think that so far in the controversy between, are we calling him Aegeus, the father, right? The strict father. So between Aegeus and his daughter and Lysander, who are in love with one another, love is set opposite to law. Right. I mean, that's what Aegeus appeals to, the law of Athens, right? I get to be right in the situation, or I get to slaughter my daughter. We've already been over how that's crazy. But anyway, so in this situation, in calling Cupid blind, it seems like, I'm going to get the girls' names mixed up, Hermia and Helena. It seems like Helena is appealing to love as something that's just as inflexible because it's against her as the law is from Hermia's perspective. And so, whereas I was expecting law versus love based on the opening scene, I'm now getting love as a law, as an inflexible law, as something that can't be tampered with or bent to one's own will, which isn't going to stop her from trying, of course. But so that's interesting to me. And I don't know what you guys make of that.
Say more about that, Ian. Why is love inflexible for Helena?
Well, it could be as simple as that she's a woman instead of a man. And so she's not in the decision-making seat in this play or in this era. And she hasn't found a way to woo Demetrius's attentions. Although we're given to believe that Demetrius was in love with her before he got an offer from Hermia's father. So that's all confusing as well. But all of that paints a picture for me of love as something that is, her experience of love is far different from Hermia's experience of love. There's something authentic about the love between Hermia and Lysander and something calculated about the love between Demetrius and Hermia. And I think that pulls out of Helena a response in kind, which is, I am going to do whatever it takes to affect the scenario myself. I'm going to interpose my will on this situation. And she appears to think that if she pulls that off, she will get the love she's looking for.
Yeah.
Which the reader, I mean, from my vantage point, the reader sits and looks at that definition of love and says, you don't understand.
Yeah.
Maybe love is something from the woods, from the green realm or whatever we're calling it, right? It's elusive and it comes upon you and it acts upon you rather than you calculating and grasping and controlling it. So I wonder if that's one of the things we're going to watch throughout the play, is this a battle over love's true definition and where it actually springs from.
And Emily, I mean, we're going to see, to flash forward to Act Two, we're going to see the undoing of Helena's kind of like love by force of will philosophy when the sprinkling of the love potion happens amongst all these lovers and everything just goes haywire, right? Yeah. Everything just gets all backwards. Emily, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love everything that Ian said. I was also thinking about how agreeable. Similar. Yeah. Agreeable. Oh, no, so I disagree. I hate everything Ian said. No, I was thinking about how Helena's vision, her vision of love is so similar to that, the one that comes from the law. Just to continue on with what Ian is saying, Aegeus and Theseus, when they basically are accusing Hermia of not knowing her own mind or not loving properly, and that she's being willful and that her love is blind. And if only she would, and it's from the other direction, right? If only she would apply the law to her understanding, then she would get the proper outcome, the proper love.
Right. Yeah. If she would only do what her father's instructing her to do, all would be well with her. I like Lysander's perspective, though. I mean, I'm a bleeding heart. I love the lovers. I think it's great. But the way that he responds is, hold on just a second. Everything that I have recommends me as well or better than Demetrius. And I have it on good authority that he was in love with somebody else a second ago. Mm-hmm, so whatever the conversation is here, it isn't about love. That's not where we're getting this decision.
Yeah.
That's true. I think that's the voice of the playwright on the whole situation.
I see the same way.
I think also, I thought that Ian, just a couple minutes ago when you couldn't remember it, whether it was Helena or Hermia, right? Which one is which, right? That's part of the play. Like the whole, just exactly what you just said, that Demetrius and Lysander are essentially the same person. They have no independent selfhood anywhere throughout the play, right? Mm. If one guy is just as good as the other guy, they have the same amount of fortune. They're the same level of handsome. They're the same level of ability, right? And they're, so pick one, right? Like, and for whatever reason, Aegeus picked Demetrius, and now he's just imposing that, not out of a true desire for happiness at all or love, right? But because he said so. Mm. Like, that's essentially the message that comes to Hermia. You know, and what Theseus says to her in a nutshell is like, you know, once you start pulling a thread out, the whole tapestry falls apart, right? And so you've got to do what your father says. Which is why we need a green world. And that's also true for Hermia and Helena. We learn that they're both considered equally pretty, both considered equally desirable. They're both of the same social status, right? They're interchangeable, except that We later learn that Hermia is kind of small and dark, and Helena is tall and fair, and that's the only difference, right? Mm-hmm. And that kind of bleeds into this whole love is blind question.
Right.
That love is something that happens to you. It doesn't matter who the person is; they're interchangeable lovers, and the love potion ends up kind of cementing that, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's this then question that Shakespeare seems to be asking about the nature of love, just exactly what you said. And is happiness out of marriage something that comes when you just accept that love is blind, or is it something that happens when you assert your independence and actually try to seek for what you want? And I frankly think the play doesn't answer that question. It just right. raises it.
Yeah. And in Oberon and Fairy Queen's Name,
Titania.
Oh, Titania.
Titania, huh. Yes, which is Titania. That's very cool. Her will is iron, absolutely. But yeah, their controversy, and I know I'm jumping ahead, but their controversy is along those same lines, Heidi. With the, are we going to, am I not your lord? Is right. basically what he said.
Hierarchy.
Who are you talking to here, right? And she says, well, am I not your lady? And all of a sudden we have what so far appears to me to be the only real relationship in the whole play, right? Between two quarreling spouses, not lovers, spouses. Mm-hmm. There's a distinction for you.
You know, happy marriages are pretty actual marriages, not happy lovers yeah. heading towards marriage, but a happy marriage is actually pretty rare in Shakespeare. And I think we'll see what we think about Titania and Oberon here.
That's going to be really fun.
Yeah.
Galen and I have been reading this book that I read 10 years ago and fell in love with. And I'm just going to plump it on the show. It's called A Failure of Nerve by Edwin Friedman. I recommend it, highest possible recommendation. It's ostensibly a book about leadership, but really it's about like all human relationships. And one of his things that he's really emphatic about is Edwin Friedman. He has this phrase, couples must separate so that they don't separate. The idea being there has to be a kind of, when you're in a relationship, it's so much easier to just never disturb the peace. You know, if something's bothering you, it's better to just never disturb the peace and to just kind of like keep that warm, intimate feeling intact. But maybe something is kind of like bothering you. Maybe something is bothering her in the back of your mind, but I'm not going to talk about it because it's just going to only, you know, like cause waves. And Friedman is no. Separate so you don't separate. You know, you have to retain your individuality within this relationship. And it is a source of pain when you like do a small separation, you know, it's a source of pain, but with the ultimate goal of like strengthening the long-term relationship.
Right. Which is heading toward a peak. The source of pain perhaps is we all feel a pressure to maintain the status quo, to maintain the feeling of intimacy, to maintain right. peace. That's it's almost like it's a law of romantic relationships, right? And so to make those waves intentionally is to stand forward and say, behold, I have failed this law, this little L yeah. law of relationships, right? But it hedges against an ultimate greater failure
yeah.
or breakdown, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. The second scene in Act One is with six Athenian tradesmen who are preparing for this play, for Theseus's wedding. I want to just talk about it for a second because we see another favorite trope of Shakespeare's, which is the play within the play. He loves the plays within the plays, and we love the plays within the plays. I want to ask you, why does he put another comedy within this kind of fantastical comedy? So the story that is going to be enacted here is the death of Pyramus and Thisbe. And Quince calls it the most lamentable comedy and most cruel death, the most cruel death of Pyramus and Thisbe. And we don't see the play in this act, but we will see it a little bit later. And it is indeed a lamentable comedy. It's just absurd, but it's funny. It's like it begs to be played with great slapstick. What is Shakespeare up to here with this comedic bit within his play. Does anyone have a suspicion?
Well, Shakespeare is, he likes to have a low plot going on in the comedies, right? So we've got the high plot with the highborn characters,
right?
And then a low plot with more, I guess we'd say, blue collar, like kind of characters who, and the low plot mirrors the high plot, right? And adds a lot of comedy, gives that opportunity for farce without making any of the high plot actors or characters look ridiculous within the play. But that, even that gets a little bit permeable once we get to Bottom and Titania, right? Which comes later in the play. But that we have with what are often called the mechanicals here, that the mechanicals are trying to put on a play about love that they are taking very seriously, but they are ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. We can see that they are ridiculous. And I think that's a little bit of what's going on in this high plot as well, that mm-hmm. these characters are taking this very, very seriously. Hermia, Demetrius, all of them, right? This, they're making something very serious that actually to us is a little bit ridiculous, right? Why in the world yeah. is Aegeus insisting on Hermia marrying Demetrius when she can marry Lysander? It's the same. That's ridiculous, right? Mm. But mm-hmm. they don't see it that way. They see themselves as putting on this lamentable tragedy. And we know that all this could be ironed out if people are willing to be reasonable for 15 seconds, right? But instead, we're going to get five acts out of this.
Right.
And I think that's a little bit of what's going on also with the mechanicals and their plot.
Yeah. Mm.
I love that.
I have taken to doing family Q&As for our Q&A session. So we'll probably bring a family on at the end of this play.
Cool.
And the first one that we did was with my friends, the Maietas, and Mercedes, one of the Maieta kids, I think Mercedes is 16. She asked a question basically about high plots and low plots. And her question was kind of like, why does Shakespeare insist on having these, like these series of basically fart jokes in these beautiful elevated plays? And I felt very gratified that I knew what Mercedes' favorite show was. Have you guys seen The Great British Baking Show?
Yes.
And I was like,
yes, we're good Americans.
I said, Mercedes, your favorite show is The Great British Baking Show. How can you ask why is there like a low plot when you like The Great British Baking Show? She's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, the comedians. The comedians yeah. are the low plot in The Great British Baking Show.
James Acaster is the low plot.
right, absolutely. He's the low plot. And it works. There's this, because it's about like, all of this fine dining and this beautiful tent and flowers and incredible ingredients. And you've got to mix in some of like Bottom and Quince into The Great British Baking Show, or it just becomes just a little bit too precious, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. What a
and
great
Shakespeare's
analogy.
A master. He's a master at this. He's like, okay, you've been with the wealthy people who are really stodgy long enough. Let's get you into the earth again and let's get you remember. And that's what, I mean, these six characters, to your point, Heidi, they're the perfect kind of low plot antidote to all the highborn characters.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. That is great.
What do we look for in Act Two? What are the kind of questions that we should be asking this play at the conclusion of Act One? Act One, we know where our plot is going. We've got, you know, whatever star-crossed lovers, these two couples that are going to meet out in the woods outside of Athens. And we know that this play is going to be performed in the wedding. That's essentially all we really know thus far. What are the questions that we should be asking going into Act Two?
I think the other great question that the play within a play raises is the same that all Shakespeare's play within a plays raise, which is the role of performance and storytelling and the relationship between fiction and reality. And I think there's a sense in which actually the play, the storytelling, is a continuum of the green world. and another lens through which to view reality. And I, as that plot develops, it raises questions about what is real and how do we understand ourselves?
Yeah.
Well, Heidi. And I think anybody after listening to this podcast or, you know, getting to the end of Act One is going to be asking, what's the forest going to be like? Right? Mm-hmm. What's it going to be like out there? They're leaving civilization, leaving everything behind to go find their lovers, which, by the way, I just feel like Helena's strategy is really bad. But here, having liked guys who didn't like me back in high school, who liked other girls, I would be like, thank goodness. Like, what do I have to do to shield Hermia and Lysander so that I could have Demetrius back to myself? Mwahaha. So I feel like her strategy is really flawed. But I mean, that's what gets the two of them into the green world. And that's what we got to have. So the next step is getting them out into the forest to see what happens. Shake things up.
Yep.
Yeah. Ian.
They stole my answer. What's going to happen in the forest? And yeah. I love the action. I love the plot. That's my favorite. And so I'm like, are there bears? I want there to be bears, right? Is someone going to get eaten? Like,
that's the exit, winter's tale.
Pursued by bear. Yeah, I know. But either way, yeah. What's going to happen in the forest? And I think to piggyback off of Emily's comment, shocker, this distinction between
it's terrible.
Right.
The distinction between what's real and what is unreal absolutely is a lens to be applied to the question of love. And so we're going to get, I would assume, some visions of unreal love, fanciful love, imaginary love, and real love throughout the rest of the play. And so that seems to be a thematic thread we ought to pay attention to going into Act Two.
We're so glad, everyone, that you joined us for Act One of A Midsummer Night's Dream. We are hosted by the Searcy Institute, which is one of the leaders of the burgeoning classical Christian renewal and education. If you'd like to know more about the Searcy Institute website, CIRCEinstitute.org. There you can learn everything that you would like to about just what is classical education. And just one little plot point addendum to that, it's believed that Shakespeare's education that he received growing up is very, very akin to a lot of the chief principles in the Christian classical education movement. So if you would like for your 8-year-old to begin speaking and conjugating verbs like William Shakespeare, please have a look, searcyinstitute.org. Please join us next week for Act Two when we enter the woods in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Thank you for joining us for The Play's the Thing. And as always, happy reading.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.